Welcome to Digital Yom, a podcast about living a symbolic life in a technological age.
Man cannot stand a meaningless life.
I'm Jason Smith, Jungian analyst and your host for this show. And in this third part of my series on the fairy tale, The Iron Stove, I explore the importance of bringing together the mind and the body in the work of the symbolic life.
It's the human soul. That's the buried treasure.
Individuation is not only an upward, but also a downward process. Without any body, there is no mind, and therefore no individuation. There's a wonderful poem by Rainer Maria Rilke, in which he describes the necessity of moving beyond the initial power of one's ideas and visions to the steady and patient work of realizing them in the world in some tangible way. And the first two verses of the poem go like this. Just as the winged energy of delight carried you over many chasms early on. Now raise the daringly imagined arch, holding up the astounding bridges. Miracle doesn't lie only in the amazing living through and defeat of danger. Miracles become miracles in the clear achievement that is earned. Toward the end of the last episode, titled Resisting Change, the second part of this series on the fairy tale The Iron Stove, I discussed the vision of beauty that was granted to the king's daughter in that tale as she scraped a hole in the stove and caught a glimpse of the golden figure of the youth trapped inside. I noted there that such a vision often feels like an achievement, a kind of arrival at a new understanding of life that will henceforth permeate all our actions and experiences. In the first flush of our encounter with something numinous, a moment of insight, of inspiration, of grace, however the vision of beauty arrives in our lives, it often feels the way Rilke describes it in his poem, like a heightened state, an uplifting rush of energy that can carry us through all obstacles, a sense of aliveness that seems to unite all the divisions within us, that eliminates the chasm that lies between who we are and who we might be. The reality is, though, as I go on to say in that episode, it is just the beginning of a commitment that will test us, an important work that will make great demands on us. And this is just what Rilke is saying in his poem. The winged energy of delight must ultimately be transformed into something more solid and lasting. The initial flight of the miraculous must become the grounded miracle of a lived reality through what he calls a clear achievement that is earned. And this is the theme of this third part of this series. A theme, as we'll see, that the next section of our story brings into focus. So I'm going to turn now to that story. And again, I'll just quickly remind you that you can find a link to the whole tale in the show notes if you want to read or listen to it in its entirety. In the previous section of the story, we saw the king's daughter free the handsome youth from his captivity in the iron stove. Before going off with her new love, though, she asks to be allowed to return to her father. Her wish is granted under the condition that she say no more than three words to the old king, a condition, of course, that she violates, causing the stove and the king's son to disappear over glass mountains and piercing swords. When she finally leaves her father's kingdom to return to the wild forest and to seek the iron stove, it is nowhere to be found. And here's where we pick up our story. For 9 days she sought it, and then her hunger grew so great that she did not know what to do, for she had nothing to live on. When it was evening, she seated herself in a small tree and made up her mind to spend the night there, as she was afraid of wild beasts. When midnight drew near, she saw in the distance a small light and thought, "Ah, there I should be saved." She got down from the tree and went towards the light, but on the way, she prayed. Then she came to a little old house, and much grass had grown all about it, and a small heap of wood lay in front of it. She thought, "Ah, whither have I come?" and peeped in through the window. But she saw nothing inside but toads, big and little, except a table covered with wine and roast meat, and the plates and glasses were of silver. Then she took courage and knocked at the door, and immediately the fat toad cried, "Little green waiting maid with the limping leg, little dog of the limping leg, hop hither and thither, and quickly see who is without." And a small toad came walking by and opened the door to her. The king's daughter enters the wild forest three times. The first two times it is either accidental or against her will. Here, she has returned to the forest in full consciousness, having made her own choice to seek out the iron stove. And this is a critical difference. In a letter that he wrote in 1940, Jung makes the following statement. "The unconscious," he states, "is useless without the human mind. It always seeks its collective purposes and never your individual destiny. Your destiny is the result of the collaboration between the conscious and the unconscious." If then we take the forest in the story as an image of the unfamiliar territory of the unconscious psyche, we discover that it contains both wild beasts and helpful animals. The wild beasts we can understand as archetypal and instinctual energies that live in everyone and that seek their own collective purposes, to use Jung's words. That is, they seek to find expression in our lives, regardless of our conscious intentions. Without the aid of consciousness, they take on the character of automatic responses and sheer reactivity. And this is what makes them wild and beast-like. And by consciousness here, I mean not only will and intention, though these are certainly important, but also a well-developed reflective capacity, together with an attitude of collaboration and participation with these unconscious, instinctual, archetypal dynamics. And when these qualities are present, the automatic and collective process is transformed into an individual one. What was mere instinctive reflex is channeled into the work of individuation. And then, like the king's daughter, we are able to move away from the domain of the wild beasts to the cottage of the helpful animals. And this brings us to the strange image of the house filled with toads, big and little. That there's a house here tells us that things are a little closer to a human state than the wilderness of the forest, right? However, there's still some wildness that clings to the place, as can be seen by its unkempt state, the overgrown grass and the heap of wood in the yard, not to mention the strange inhabitants, the toads that dwell within. And to be clear, the point is not that we should get rid of the instinctual aspects of our psychological life, but that we should come into a conscious relationship with them. While we do not want to be overpowered by our instincts and impulses, neither do we want to tame them or sanitize them out of existence. In their wildness is their life. They are a part of the life of the body, and as Jung says in our opening quote, without any body, there is no mind, and therefore no individuation. The spirit needs to come into contact with the living reality of the body. And this is where the symbol of the toad comes in. According to Western alchemy, toads are symbolic of the element of earth. Its head is very heavy, says one alchemical writer about the toad, and it gazes at the earth. For this reason, it denotes the philosophic earth, which cannot fly, as it is firm and solid. Upon it, as a foundation, the golden house is to be built. The toad, in other words, represents that element which keeps the spirit from flying away and connects it with the earth, with the body, as a foundation upon which the golden house is to be built. The earthy toad points to the possibility of a lived experience of the spirit, of a fully embodied life infused with the numinous, of that vision of beauty becoming a manifest reality in the actuality of the day-to-day. And as we'll see in the next section of the story, the encounter with the toads is both a reflection and a reinforcement of an important change happening in the king's daughter herself. So here let's return to the next part of our tale. When she entered, they all bade her welcome, and she was forced to sit down. They asked, "Where have you come from, and whither are you going?" Then she related all that had befallen her, and how, because she had transgressed the order which had been given her, not to say more than three words, the stove and the king's son also had disappeared. And now she was about to seek him over the hill and dale until she found him. Then the old fat one said, "Little green waiting maid with the limping leg, little dog of the limping leg, hop hither and thither and bring me the great box." Then the little one went and brought the box. After this, they gave her meat and drink and took her to a well-made bed, which felt like silk and velvet, and she laid herself therein, in God's name, and slept. When morning came, she arose, and the old toad gave her three needles out of the great box, which she was to take with her. They would be needed by her, for she had to cross a high glass mountain and go over three piercing swords and a great lake. If she did all this, she would get her lover back again. The toads welcome the king's daughter into their house. And the first thing they ask her is the very same question that was put to her by the iron stove at the beginning of the tale. Where have you come from, and whither are you going? These questions, as I pointed out in the first episode of this series, titled The Life of the Spirit, are questions about the meaning of life. What is the source of our being? Why are we here? To what ends should our lives be directed? Where have we come from? And where are we going? The first time these questions were put to the hero of our story, her answer amounted to little more than she was lost and just wanted to get back home. She showed no interest in her individual destiny, which requires one to take up the responsibility for one's own existence. She exhibited, rather, a regressive longing for containment in the known and familiar world of the collective. This time, however, when the crucial question comes, she tells the toads the story of finding the iron stove, falling in love with the king's son, and then losing him. And then she states that now she was about to seek him over the hill and dale until she found him. Clearly, a new attitude has blossomed in the king's daughter. She's no longer seeking to retreat into safety, but is determined to venture out into uncertainty and struggle and difficulty and probably even pain and suffering. To borrow a phrase from the poet David White, who in turn was borrowing from that great visionary William Blake, she is setting out with a firm persuasion. She is in pursuit of a life of meaning and is willing to accept the challenges and the perils that it entails. And it is just because of this firm persuasion that the toads reveal themselves to be helpful animals. Right after the king's daughter tells her story and declares her intention, the big toad sends the little one to get a box from which they will give her the necessary tools to help her meet the trials that she will face on her journey. There is an important and subtle interplay in all of this between intention and instinct, the conscious and the unconscious, spirit and body. And we cannot say that one leads the other or that one is more important than the other. Each finds its fulfillment, as it were, in the other. And this is the key takeaway here. When Jung says that without the body, there is no mind, he's not making a reductionist argument that the mind is merely the effect of prior physiological or neurological activity, the byproduct of the brain. He's saying that until a thought, an idea, or an inspiration is bodied forth in our lives in some way, is made real and tangible in the world, it may as well be as if it never existed. It is potentiality, but not actuality. Individuation, we could say, depends upon the realization of the idea that we ourselves are. And this, I would suggest, means that the symbolic life is nothing less than a devotional practice. A change in the conscious attitude, writes Marie-Louise von Franz, has always to be worked out first by a human effort and with human devotion. Devotion is the act of dedicating oneself to a higher meaning or a higher purpose. It is that attitude in which, so to speak, heaven and earth meet. It is the means by which the body is inspirited and the spirit is embodied. Or, to paraphrase the alchemists, it is the foundation on which the golden house of the true self is to be built. I'll be back in just a minute with this week's parting words. You'll find a list of all the sources used in this week's episode in the show notes. You'll also find links to connect with me on social media, as well as for my book, Religious But Not Religious, Living a Symbolic Life, available from Chiron Publications. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting the production of this show. You can do so for as little as the cost of a cup of coffee at Buy Me a Coffee. You'll even find some extras for this show posted there from time to time. Just hit the Support the Show link in the show notes. Thank you very much. Now here are this week's parting words. I said earlier that the spirit and the body find their fulfillment in each other. And here I want to leave you with a quote from Abraham Joshua Heschel, in which he affirms the ultimate value of both of these poles of our human psychological and spiritual life. And here's what he says. We must neither disparage the body nor sacrifice the spirit. The body is the discipline, the pattern, the law. The spirit is inner devotion, spontaneity, freedom. The body without the spirit is a corpse. The spirit without the body is a ghost. Until next time.